Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for August 2004. This is issue number 233, and I'm your host, Fred Bowlby, the publisher of the DX Audio Service. My address is 706 McKenzie Drive, Lima, Ohio, 45805-1835. Telephone number 419-228-6223. If you live in the United States of America or Canada and would like to become a member of the DX Audio Service, the cost of a subscription is $28. To Europe and elsewhere, it's $40. Those prices are also the renewal rates. Tapes are sent by first-class mail, and you keep your cassettes. If you'd like to subscribe, make your check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to me at the address that I just mentioned, or simply log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org/member and sign up using our PayPal credit card system. Well, let's jump right into the DX Audio Service for yet another month. Here's Bill Hale from Texas.
Oh, wait, the wires were in backwards. I think I got them right now. Let's do that again. Here's AM switch for the DX Audio Service for August 2004. First of all, call letter changes on 540. The former KSRK in Carmel Valley, California is now KMEO with Spanish talk format. 660 WCIX in Wilkinsburg, Pennsylvania is now WPYT. 670 WRJR in Claremont, Virginia has taken the new calls of WPMH. 850 WMCD, Statesboro, Georgia, now is WPTB. Also on 850, WDJC in Birmingham, Alabama has taken the new calls of WXJC. On 860, KBEE in Salt Lake City, Utah is now KKAT. On 890, KQXI, a new station not yet on the air up in Meridian, Idaho, has changed to KDJQ. WRFX in Miami on 940 has taken their old call letters of WINZ. 1010 WQYK in Sefner, Florida is now WBZZ. Also on 1010 WPMH in Portsmouth, Virginia is now WRJR. If you'll notice, the 670 and 1010 stations just traded calls there. 1090 WBZB in Selma, North Carolina is now WTSB. WCTM 1130 in Eaton, Ohio is now WEDI. 1180 WJJF in Hope Valley, Rhode Island is now WCNX. 1190 WXBH in Cobleskill, New York has taken the new call of WSDE. KSFB 1220 in Palo Alto, California has taken the new call of KNTS. 1290 WKZT in Fulton, Kentucky, their new call is WFUL. On 1340 WINZ in Augusta, Georgia, their new call is WSGF. 1420 KREL in California, Missouri, their new call is KRRL. 1470 KVVZ in Abilene, Texas, their new call is KYYW. And 1550 WDLR in Delaware, Ohio, their new call is WXOL. By the way, that station has a construction permit to move to Westerville, Ohio. One newly granted station to report on 670, an experimental synchronous station, WR2XJR in Portsmouth, Virginia. Their CP has been granted with 700 watts directional, nighttime only, with programming from WPMH 670, which, as you just heard in the call letter changes, was WRJR, but now WPMH. The following construction permits are now on the air. 550 WSAU in Wausau, Wisconsin is on the air with 15,000 watts during the day, 20,000 watts at night using two patterns. 570 WDNZ Raleigh, North Carolina, they're on the air with a kilowatt during the day, 52 watts at night, non-directional. 590 KTIE San Bernardino, California, they're on with 2,000 watts during the day, 1,000 watts at night using two patterns. They still have another application on file for 2,500 watts during the day, 960 watts at night. 620 KMJC, Mount Shasta, California, they're on the air with 1,000 watts day, 29 watts at night, non-directional. 640 WVLG in Wildwood, Florida, they're now on the air with 930 watts during the day, 860 watts at night, non-directional. KXEB 910 in Frisco, Texas, they've relocated to this North Dallas suburb from Sherman, Texas. They now have a kilowatt during the day, 500 watts at night, using two patterns from a new tower site. 920 WAFS Atlanta, Georgia, their CP for 5,000 watts during the day, 488 watts at night, non-directional, is now on. 950 KJR, Seattle, Washington. They're on the air with 50,000 watts day and night using two patterns from their new three-tower site. 970 KIAK, Fairbanks, Alaska. The CP to raise power to become 10,000 watts day and night non-directional is now on. 1130 WQFX, Gulfport, Mississippi. Their CP to increase power to become 1,000 watts daytime only non-directional is on. 1230 KWG, Stockton, California. They're now on the air with 900 watts day and night non-directional. 1270 WCGC, Belmont, North Carolina. They're now on the air with 10,000 watts during the day, 500 watts at night, using two patterns. WHKY 1290, Hickory, North Carolina. Their CP for 50,000 watts during the day, 1,000 watts at night, using two patterns, was heard testing and may be on by the time you hear this. 1300 WIMO, Winder, Georgia. Their CP for 650 watts during the day, 50 watts at night, non-directional, is on. 1310 KTCK, Dallas, Texas. Their CP for 9,000 watts days, 5,000 watts at night, using two patterns, is now on the air. 1400 KENT, Parowan, Utah. They've now got 800 watts day and night, non-directional. And on 1490 KCFC, Boulder, Colorado. Their CP to increase power to 1,000 watts day and night is now on. Some construction permits that have just been granted. WNSR 560 in Brentwood, Tennessee has been granted a CP to increase their day power level to become 4,500 watts during the day, 63 watts at night, directional during daylight hours only. KICY 850 in Nome, Alaska, CP has been granted to increase nighttime power to become 50,000 watts all hours using a simple directional pattern during critical hours only. 900 WICV, Granite Falls, North Carolina. A CP has been granted to increase daytime power to become 2,500 watts during the day, 251 watts at night, all non-directional. On 1070 KILR, Estherville, Iowa, a CP is granted to add night service. There are now 250 watts during the day, 48 watts at night, using two patterns. 1080 KNDK, Langdon, North Dakota. CP was granted to add nighttime service. They'll be 1,000 watts during the day, 45 watts at night, non-directional when they build that facility. 1130 WQIS, Camden, South Carolina. The CP was granted to add night service. When operational, they will become 1,000 watts during the day, 7 watts at night, non-directional. WXLA 1180, Diamonddale, Michigan, has been granted a CP to increase the daytime power and add critical hours operation. When built, they'll be 10,000 watts during the day and 2,000 watts during critical hours using two patterns. 1220 WJUN, Mexico, Pennsylvania, has been granted a CP to raise their nighttime power. When they get it on the air, it'll be 1,000 watts during the day, 46 watts at night, non-directional. 1260 KWEI in Weezer, Idaho, a CP has been granted to increase daytime power to become 10,000 watts during the day, 60 watts at night, all non-directional. 1520 WDMN, Toledo, Ohio, has been granted a CP to consolidate their day and night tower arrangements. They have been two sites for years. This will all be from a new five-tower site. They'll have 500 watts during the day, 400 watts at night using two patterns, and a change of city of license to Rossford, Ohio. 1530 WVBF in Middleborough Center, Massachusetts. The CP has been granted to increase the daytime power and to add critical hours operation. When built, they'll be 2,200 watts during the day, 2 watts at night, 940 watts during critical hours, all non-directional. And finally, WVFC 1530 in McConnellsburg, Pennsylvania has been granted a CP to move to 1180 kilohertz with 510 watts daytime only, non-directional, with a city of license change to King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. Some Canadian news to report this month. The CRTC has received the following applications. CFFX 960 in Kingston, Ontario is asking to add a 50-watt FM station at 93.7 in order to improve its signal in the downtown area of Kingston. They state that the population in the core downtown area and in areas adjacent to it are experiencing drops in signal volume and interference. CJNS 1240 Meadow Lake, Saskatchewan has applied to convert its facility to 102.3 FM with 45,000 watts ERP. The CBC has proposed to replace CBXJ860, their 40-watt repeater of CBX740 in Edmonton at Jasper, Alberta, with an FM station at 98.1 megahertz with 259 watts ERP. NCKKC 880 Nelson, British Columbia is asking to convert to 106.9 megahertz with 2,000 watts. More notes from here and there. Jerry Conkling of Greenbelt, Maryland emailed saying that both 540 in Pocomoke City, Maryland and 700 in Walkersville, Maryland were using the WDMV calls. I wrote back suggesting they were just simulcasting and both had a CP and an application pending. Jerry promises to keep us informed on that particular situation. Last month, we reported that KUTR 820 Taylorsville, Utah, a new station not yet on the air, has a CP for 50,000 watts during the day, 2,500 watts at night, and 10,000 watts during critical hours using three patterns, but had applied for an amendment asking that the CH operation be upgraded to 50 kilowatts. Mike Reardon from Salt Lake City writes to say he has spoken with John Dinelli, their chief engineer, who said KUTR has been granted that change, but I must tell you listeners, nothing official has appeared at the FCC for that particular item. So we are treating the application as just that, an application. KUTR plans to be testing in October. Their nighttime pattern, by the way, is fairly slender, using six towers and directed at 019 degrees, protecting WBAP, while the CH pattern looks like a cartoon's talk balloon using two towers headed 347 degrees. Stations reported to be silent since the last AM switch, KXKS 1190 Albuquerque, New Mexico, KIQN 1010 Tooele, Utah, they remain silent, KITT 1370 Pearl City, Hawaii, and WVMG 1440 Cochrane, Georgia. Back on the air, WEWC 1160, Callahan, Florida, WEBO 1330, Owego, New York, WSHN 1510, Fremont, Michigan, they're back on with ESPN radio programming, simulcasting with co-owned WUBR 1490, either on low power or very inefficient antenna, and WAZL 1490, Hazleton, Pennsylvania, and WYMM 1530, Jacksonville, Florida, which is no longer Spanish but gospel. Thanks to Dave Schmidt for reporting the WEBO and WAZL items. Also thanks go out to Sean Axelrod, Phil Borsma, Wayne Heinen, Al Ogrizovich, and Dave Schmidt for contributions sprinkled throughout this presentation. Well, my time is up. I thank you for yours. Now let's head to Florida and see what frequency John Balker has queued up for us this month on the Travel Log.
Thanks a lot, Bill. We're going to start today in New York City.
News is WCBS New York.
Sports is
WCBS New York.
Where it's at and where it's going to be is
WCBS New York.
No matter where the news is made, we're here to tell it
best.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the August 2004 Travelogue. I wanted to start right off with that WCBS jingle because anyone who lived in or around that part of the country back in the 1980s would remember that jingle, and it was a prize one. They don't have time for that sort of thing anymore, I guess. Say, before I get started, I just want to tell you what a great month I've had. Just listening to new tapes and some older tapes that have been sent in. Let's see, Jerome Peterson out in California and Michael Piesco in Dearborn, Michigan. Mitch Pomerantz in Pasadena, he sent in a recording that got here too late, Mitch. I sent you a letter. I hope you got it by now and all that. And Frank Aiden, and oh, I'm going to skip two or three others. I'm sure that I don't mean to, but thanks so very much for your acknowledgement of the Travelogue and the contributions you're making to it. That's just great. We're going to be moving right along at 880 because I want to get it done today. And we don't have all that many stations on the frequency, but we're going to move down to a station that's really not even on the air anymore. Linda and I were out in the western part of Virginia, not far from Roanoke, back in 1985, and caught this dandy.
Lake Radio, WLQE Manita,
WYMY Bedford,
Smith Mountain Lake.
And we were there again in 1998.
WBLR Manita and WLVA Lynchburg.
CNN Radio News, I'm John Lisk.
but as of last September at least, 880 in Roanoke is quiet. Let's go down to the southeast part of North Carolina to find out what time it is.
Hey, Briggs & Sons Tire Time, it's 8:01, 1 minute after 8 o'clock, and you're in RR Country with 880 on your AM dial. We're WRRZ in Clinton. Good morning, everybody, with Big Old Country Dave and Exile.
Keep it in the middle of the road, honey, let's keep it in the middle of the road. Right door, left, right down, the center we go.
Well, that's kind of a cutie song, I think. Now, if we go out to the western part of North Carolina, we come to mountains and this 5,000-watt daytimer.
880 WPEK, Fairview, Asheville, The Peak.
I used to spend my nights out in a bar room.
Now, you see, that tune isn't quite as cute, so we don't play it as much. Okay. And right in the middle of the state of North Carolina is this 850-watt daytime station.
Serving Courtney, Huntsville, and Stanleyville with the gospel of Jesus Christ, this is 880 Radio, WPIP, Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
And if we step lightly across the North Carolina-Georgia border, we come to this 5,000-watt daytimer.
Northeast Georgia's Gospel Giant, serving 23 counties with gospel Monday through Friday, 6 a.m. until 1 p.m., Saturdays, 6 a.m. until 9 a.m., and Sundays all day long. We're WBKZ, Jefferson, Athens, Gainesville, Z88.
This is AUN News. I'm Jay Harris.
And perhaps not too surprisingly, but that's the most southern station we have in the southeast part of the United States. There's nothing at 880 in Florida or Alabama or even Mississippi. So we start swinging north, and we come to the strangest slogan of any station we have in the collection. What do you make of this?
Parasites cannot exist without carriers. WMDB 880 on your dial, Nashville, Tennessee, a carrier.
Now, when we return to our WMDB countdown of the top 10 most requested tunes for this smooth and sweetheart Saturday afternoon.
Parasites on your station? I tell you, not only am I not going to listen to your selected Saturday afternoon music, I didn't even want your station in my house. Goodness sakes. Let's move up to the capital of Ohio.
Positive talk. AM 880. WRFD, Columbus, Worthington.
The following program is sponsored by NAC Vitamin Company.
You know, I could be wrong, but it seems to me that station keeps changing its city of license about every 4 or 5 years. I don't know. Mark Stricker, 12 years ago this month, was out in the middle of Illinois.
WINU, 880 Highland, Illinois.
Sermon hymn this morning is hymn number 174, We Would Be Building.
And then Linda and I passed through town just 3 years ago this month.
Reaching out through all of Mid-America from the St. Louis Metro East, we're The Bridge, 880 AM, WCBW Highland.
With SRN News, I'm Rich Thomason in Washington.
Well, okay, we're going to go straight up the Mississippi River now, and when we get as far north as Wisconsin, we'll turn over toward the Eau Claire market and dream for the day that all radio stations give IDs as clearly as this.
Your news and information station for West Central Wisconsin. This is AM 880 WMEQ Menominee.
CBS News, I'm Bill Whitney. A rip-roaring comeback for the stock market. At the close, the Dow is nearly 500 points higher at about 8,200.
And you have to understand that we play more of the newscasts that we like, too, as well as the music. Well, we jump across the Mississippi River, come down the western bank, and now we're in Arkansas.
Country, KGHD, Sheridan, Little Rock, Arkansas, Country Giant.
Well, We move now into state number 32, that's the Lone Star State of Texas, and the towers of these two stations that have a common ID are less than 30 miles apart.
If you're thinking about it, we're talking about it. Talking about it. Talk Radio 950, KPRC, Houston, KJOJ, Conroe, Houston's place to talk.
Welcome to the program.
Talk Radio 950, KPRC.
And you notice they don't even mention the KJOJ is at 880 on the dial, so... Dale Hamm picked that one up for us back in 2001. Thank you, Dale. And back about 22 years ago, Linda and I were passing through Houston and caught this ID.
Now this update from ABC News.
Well, yes, they had a cleaner sound before, but... That isn't the way you judge the success of a radio station, I'm afraid, anymore. Speaking of clean sound, however, we go out to the middle of Nebraska for one of the cleanest 50,000-watt sounds on the air.
I'm Larry Bear in New York. Join us next week when our special guest will be Tim McGraw on Stars of Country, a presentation of Westwood One, first in country.
KRVN, Lexington, Nebraska.
Here's the latest from ABC News. I'm Michael Barr.
Now, I'll tell you why I love to listen to KRVM when I'm out in that part of the country. It's little program segments like this.
Four times a day, and bulletins, watches, and warnings whenever they're issued. By the way, the coldest temperature ever recorded, Prospect Creek, Alaska. 80 degrees below zero on January 23rd, 1971.
KRVN, Lexington, Nebraska, 1130 Central, 1030 Mountain Time.
Well, we head north now to the Treasure State and a station on the outskirts of Glacier National Park.
We're out of time here, folks, but be patient. We'll be back in 21 hours. We'll see you then.
God-fearing radio for Western Montana. News Talk 880, KJJR, Whitefish, Kalispell, Columbia Falls.
From ABC News, I'm Doug Limerick.
And well to the southwest of Montana, we come to our announcer's mistake of the month.
KHAC in Window Rock, it's Avenida, New Mexico, and KWIM in Window Rock, Arizona.
I should explain, that's Navajo for telling the announcer that he made a grievous mistake and he's fired. But you think I know Navajo, huh? Oh, I don't. Let's move out of Arizona and New Mexico, and we'll get into California. Your logbook will tell you this next 880 station is in Salinas, but this was recorded in 1995, and they were in Gonzales, right next door.
Sharing the spirit at AM 88, this is KKMC, Gonzales, Salinas, Monterey, Santa Cruz.
Now, with our dials locked at 880, we'll head north out of California up to Dallas, Oregon.
This is KWIP Dallas. Esta es KWIP Dallas.
And while we're up here in Oregon listening to Dallas, we might as well tune in to Phoenix, Oregon.
Highs near 70 degrees, overnight lows probably 30 to 35. All day, every day, news from around the world. This is CNN Headline News on KCMC AM 880, Phoenix, Medford.
And lastly, up here in the Great Northwest, we come to the third and final 50,000-watt flamethrower at 880 on the dial, serving Seattle and Tacoma.
Ferrante and Teicher and his orchestra on 50,000-watt KIXI, Mercer Island, Seattle.
Good morning. Here's what's new. KIXI News at 8 o'clock. I'm Liz Summers.
Say, do you notice that news sounder? It's What's New, the song. That station and KNEW in Oakland are the only two that use that for a news sounder, and I don't understand why. Well, that does it for 880 in the continental United States, but Ron Gitshire, he brought back something from the Canal Zone.
Esta es
Voz Cristiana.
Esta es Radio Voz Cristiana.
Say, I hope you're making your plans to come to the Batavia, New York National Radio Club Convention. Oh, yeah, we're going to be there with bells on and all kinds of goodies for you. Say, if you want to send me any IDs of stations in your own local area, here's how to contact me. I am John Bowker, B-O-W-K-E-R, mailing address P.O. Box 5192, Sun City Center, Florida, 33571-5192. You can send me IDs by email if you'd like, using MP3 to johnb@nrc.org. Or you can send cassettes or CDs, whatever best for you. And now, here's Mark.
This is Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service. Many of you will recall an interview we did with John McKinney, engineer in charge of the famous FCC Grand Island monitoring station. Now we're pleased to excerpt an article written by John McKinney entitled An Historical Sketch of the Grand Island Monitoring Station. It appeared in the QCWA Journal, summer 1996. To old-timers in radio, certain place names stood out. Arlington, Virginia, Chatham, Massachusetts, Rocky Point, Long Island, Bolinas, California, Grand Island, Nebraska. These were locations for powerful transmitting facilities. All but the Nebraska site, which was known for its unique ability to receive radio signals, much to the chagrin of commercial and amateur operators alike. The establishment in 1929 by the radio division of the U.S. Department of Commerce of its first radio monitoring station was soon to spread the name of Grand Island, Nebraska across the globe. The phenomenal growth of radio broadcasting, AM radio, from its inception in a Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania basement was cause for concern in the regulatory agency and the new industry itself. New stations, licensed and unlicensed, were springing up almost daily, and if order was to be preserved, it was conceded that a monitoring facility was needed. There were comparatively few radio services prior to 1930, the primary users being ships and coastal stations, point-to-point telegraph, AM broadcasting, and radio amateurs, with the amateurs far outnumbering other facilities. Police and aviation radio were in their infancy, and the principal means of radio communication was telegraph. Low and medium frequencies were widely used, and the short waves, 200 meters or less, were relegated to the amateurs for whatever use they might make of them. The heart of the new monitoring station was to be a primary standard of frequency, a means whereby engineers at the station could measure the frequency of received signals to determine the compliance of licensees with their frequency assignments. Prior to this time, frequency measurements were made at the transmitter site, usually with a calibrated wave meter or decrometer. Such a system had its drawbacks, and a search was made for a suitable means of off-the-air measurements of frequency. First consideration was the purchase of equipment utilizing an oscillating pendulum. Such a device was under study by the Westinghouse Electric and Manufacturing Company, and consideration for purchase was made. By way of explanation, the described apparatus that was under consideration was to drive a clock which was to be compared daily with National Naval Observatory time signals and corrected to produce an accuracy of measurement of one part in 200,000. Considering the broadcast tolerance of plus or minus 50 cycles at that time, this was considered sufficient accuracy. But the contract to purchase the pendulum standard was abandoned due to the inability of the contractor to satisfy all requirements, but not before a large concrete pedestal for the machine had been poured in the basement of the new monitoring station. It stands there today, never used. About this same time, Westinghouse was busily engaged in design of a quartz crystal frequency standard, and a contract was awarded for the purchase of two such standards. These were massive devices, and with their associated equipment, occupied hundreds of square feet of floor space in the building. Powered by batteries charged by motor generator sets, these standards continued to function and provide accurate measurement standards at this station until the mid-1950s, when they were finally discarded in favor of smaller units with slightly better accuracy. Station description. The location for the Central Frequency Monitoring Station was chosen to be Grand Island, Nebraska, after an extensive search indicated the flat prairie regions of central Nebraska to be most suitable. It is situated about 6 miles from Grand Island and about a half mile north of the Lincoln Highway. Telephone, telegraph, and power supply are brought into the station through a half mile of underground lead-covered cable. Most of the antennas for shortwave reception are directional and are located away from the receivers, in some cases as far as 800 feet. One array receives from east or west and another from the south. For long-wave reception, two large loops have been set up at right angles, crossing at the center. A goniometer arrangement in connection with a single-wire antenna permits unidirectional reception over 360 degrees. Other antennas of the half-wave single-doublet type provided for reception of the intermediate wavelengths, constituting the balance of the band covered. Full-scale operation of the station began in 1932. No record of the first official notice of violation is available, but it was probably mailed out in July of 1932 and countersigned by Benjamin Wolf, manager. The Communications Act of 1934 saw the birth of the Federal Communications Commission and an expansion of the powers of the regulatory agency. The high frequencies were now in full use, with new radio services being established and licensed each year. The VHF spectrum was first put to use by the amateurs and then by a myriad of mobile services such as public safety, industrial and land transportation. In 1939, Congress passed the National Defense Act, and the complexion of the monitoring stations began to change. By this time, additional stations were in operation or rapidly being constructed across the nation. Stations came online at Millis, Massachusetts, Marietta, Georgia, Laurel, Maryland, Allegan, Michigan, Kingsville, Texas, Santa Ana, California, San Leandro, California, and Portland, Oregon, to name just a few. From these and others designated as primary monitoring stations, crews were sent out to establish small secondary stations in rented buildings and farmhouses. The chief difference between a primary and secondary station was the size of the installation and the staff necessary to operate it. Primary stations were equipped with long-range, high-frequency direction finders, whereas the secondary stations had loop direction finders in mobile units for close-in direction finding. Throughout World War II, there were two distinct operations at the monitoring station. The field division personnel, known as routine, continued in their role of routine enforcement, and the newly formed and much larger radio intelligence division surveyed the spectrum for clandestine and espionage activities. For this operation, equipment facilities were greatly expanded and operational techniques devised that made it virtually impossible for any radio transmission to go undetected. By war's end, the RID had handled and solved nearly 200 cases of radio espionage or suspected espionage activity. Until the advent of World War II, there was little need for a system of rapid communications between commission offices. With the growth of the monitoring system and the introduction of direction-finding facilities, a means was required for coordinating operations and transmitting bearings to a plotting center for triangulation. Message traffic was handled between Washington and the primary monitoring stations by TWIX. This took care of volume traffic, but was unsuited for rapid exchange of information. The RID established a CW network between all of its offices and monitoring stations. Using tactical call letters, a wide range of frequency assignments, and encoded alert procedures, monitoring personnel manned what was probably the most elaborate radio telegraph network ever assembled. Net control facilities were located at Laurel, Maryland and San Leandro, California, handling the European War or Pacific War traffic separately or jointly as the needs demanded. By this time, monitoring stations had also been set up in the Hawaiian Islands, Alaska, and Puerto Rico. By war's end, a leased private line teletype circuit connected the primary stations with monitoring control in Washington, and the radio circuits extended this facility to the secondary stations as well as for providing for backup. The post-war era. 1946 saw the merger of the radio intelligence and the field division. Personnel with career aspirations and potential were absorbed by the various field offices and remaining monitoring stations. The post-war years created a new dimension for our direction-finding network, the location of ships and planes in distress. As most craft were then equipped with high-frequency transmitting apparatus, it followed that the FCC network was in a position to fix the location of lost aircraft and vessels. The peak of such assistance was probably reached in the early 1950s, when as many as three or four such assists might occur in a week's time. With the transition to VHF communications and the introduction of sophisticated electronic navigation devices, the need for FCC assistance declined. Balloon tracking. An interesting project involving our direction-finding network took place in the 1950s. In cooperation with other governmental agencies, the Field Engineering Bureau contracted to provide location fixes on high-altitude free-floating balloons. These balloons, measuring 100 or more feet in diameter, were being launched from various points in the country in a study of the high-altitude air currents or jet streams. Each balloon carried a small radio transmitter that transmitted temperature and altitude information in coded data form. Constant tracking of the course of the balloon and copying of the code groups was accomplished by the monitoring staff. Many of these craft traveled in excess of 100 miles per hour and would go from coast to coast. The retrieval of the balloon package at the end of the flight was of utmost importance, and when the balloon was shot down by a command radio signal, our location fixes became increasingly important. Mobile monitoring. The post-war era saw a boom in VHF-UHF frequency usage. In the broadcast field, TV and FM were new words on everyone's lips. Aviation and marine radio moved, at least in part, to the very high frequencies. Virtually every taxi cab in America acquired a radio. Police, contractors, veterinarians, railroads, telephone companies, and hosts of others were assigned portions of the VHF-UHF spectrum. Due to the limited range of the higher frequencies, a new approach to monitoring enforcement took place. As a preliminary program, the FCC began operation of a mobile TV-FM enforcement vehicle. The first such vehicle was based at Laurel, Maryland, at the Commission's laboratory. When a second vehicle was added, it went to the West Coast. The third such vehicle operated from Grand Island. Equipped to make the many engineering measurements required for enforcement of the regulations, these vehicles travel thousands of miles each year, monitoring and inspecting the television and FM broadcast stations in their area. A third type of mobile monitoring is conducted from here, microwave monitoring. A vehicle equipped with receivers, dish-type antennas, and spectrum analysis equipment covers an 8-state area, driving from microwave tower to microwave tower, measuring frequencies, bandwidth, and making baseline analysis of microwave systems. Due to its unique geographical location in the center of the U.S., one of the first citizens band enforcement units was established at Grand Island in 1973. From here, a team of specially trained engineers in direction-finding equipped vehicles travel throughout Mid-America, tracking down violators of the citizens band rules and locating unlicensed operators. Conclusion. The present area of the Grand Island station comprises 200 acres of land, 160 acres dedicated to monitoring purposes, and 40 acres used for antennas and buildings for the transmitting complex. Buildings are essentially the same as originally planned, with the addition of a transmitter house and an office building for the special enforcement facility. Total staffing, 18 persons. 8 engineers, 6 technicians, 3 clerical, 1 custodial. And the final paragraph written by John McKinney. On January 16, 1973, the Grand Island Monitoring Station was entered in the National Register of Historic Places, the first FCC property so designated, and indeed a distinct honor. It will close down in June 1996. And that's the 73 from John McKinney, W0AP. Perhaps you heard our interview with this gentleman slightly before his death in 2001. What a great and engaging time we had talking to him, and what a piece of radio history he and the Grand Island Monitoring Station represent. This is Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service. We'll be back again next month with another Clear Channel band scan. Till then, good listening, DXers.
The Federal Communications Commission has issued a major report dated February 19, 2004, about a low-power FM interference testing program. The Prometheus Radio Group has summarized the report under the headline, Federal Communications Commission Vindicates Low Power FM. And they go on to say that Congress should make more room for LPFM stations. They have written a summary report, which will be read by Richard Cox. Richard, welcome to our group. Tell us just a bit about yourself.
Thank you very much. I'm originally from Arizona and spent 6 years in electronics in the Navy, and after that I went into the medical field and have been within the biomedical engineering field for now 23 years working with electronic systems.
You told me once you had had some microphone experience.
Yes, on board the USS Ranger aircraft carrier, we had our own radio station and then also worked within the acting field as well.
Well, you know, Richard, here in Sun City Center, we have proposed the construction of a low-power FM broadcast station, but we have found that so far they are not allowing us to build one here because the band is too crowded, and that's partly because of the third adjacent channel problem that other broadcasters are saying. We would cause interference to reading services for the blind. So this report is very important. Why don't you tell us what it says?
The Federal Communications Commission released a major report today, February 20th, concerning its low-power FM radio service. The FCC is making its recommendation to Congress that they remove the third adjacent frequency restrictions that keep low-power FM radio out of most American communities, especially out of our cities. This act will open the doors to hundreds, if not thousands, of new potential community radio stations in the United States, more essential than ever in a time of increasing media consolidation and decreasing access to the airwaves. The original granting of licenses for the low-power FM service was stopped in its tracks in December of 2000, when Congress, under the recommendations of the National Association of Broadcasters and NPR, placed an exorbitant protection standard on the FM broadcast band. Convinced by the corporation's cries of interference, Congress passed a law keeping low-power radio off of most of its intended frequencies, and over 60% of the potential stations were lost. When Congress listened to the big corporate lobbyists who were telling them that our 100-watt radio stations would interfere with their 100,000-watt Goliaths, they were flouting decades and decades of engineering precedent, said Prometheus Radio Project Technical Director Pete Tridish. Everyone in the business, including the FCC, knew that there was room for our stations on the dial. Now, Congress knows it for a fact, and it's their job to pass the law allowing more LPFM stations to be built. LPFM licenses are granted to groups that promise to broadcast non-commercial, locally produced broadcasting that will serve our regions and towns. The Prometheus Radio Project, alongside many other national organizations, fought for the implementation of these licenses at the turn of the last century. Prometheus will work to get the groups who lost out on LPFM in 2000 back into the game, helping them apply for stations and get their voices into their communities. We're very glad to see that the FCC is telling Congress what we've known all along to be true, said low-power FM broadcaster Mike Shea of Environmental Action Station WRYR-LP in Anne Arundel County, Maryland. I'm going to work overtime to tell folks all over the country that now is the time to ask their Congress people to bring stations to their communities.
Well, you know, Richard, the Prometheus Radio Project is an advocacy group that builds and proliferates and works to further the accessibility to low-power FM community radio stations. And they also work for the movement for a more democratic media and communications rights all over the country and all over the world. So thanks very much for your participation here, Richard.
I very much enjoyed it and appreciate the opportunity to do so.
At this time, please turn over your tape to side 2.